Within the Bush administration, by the time of the Iraq invasion, this free market vision of a single, liquid global oil market had taken hold as a kind of quiet conventional wisdom. It was seen by some within the administration as a sophisticated basis for thinking about American oil security, as opposed to the misguided risk board model of the 1970s. Rumsfeld and Stephen Hadley, the deputy national security advisor, as well as many of the economists who advised President Bush at the National Security Council and the National Economic Council, all had independently come to the same conclusions as Feith. Their consensus had clear implications for the Bush administration's energy policy. If oil constituted a unified worldwide market, and if the United States would be an importer in that market for an indefinite time, then it was in the interest of the United States to promote policies, free trade, open markets, low taxes, maximized oil production everywhere, that would fill the global pool with as much new oil as possible, and thus keep global oil prices low to the benefit of the American economy. The alternative policy, the pursuit of energy independence by one means or another, was unnecessary, too expensive, and unrealistic. This was precisely what Lee Raymond believed, and what he had reiterated to Vice President Dick Cheney when they met in Washington soon after Bush took office. Cheney understood and agreed. Besides Cheney, Raymond told his colleagues at ExxonMobil, he had met only one other world leader who truly understood how global liquid oil markets worked and what this implied for foreign policy: British Prime Minister Tony Blair. Blair joked that it was good that most politicians did not understand the oil markets, because if they did, they'll think they can do something about it. Although Bush's national security team generally accepted Feith's vision of global oil, some of them offered partial dissents. Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell were each struck by the destructive role of oil wealth in the development of African political economies. They credited aspects of the resource curse thesis. Paul Wolfowitz, the Deputy Defense Secretary, also accepted the resource curse thesis, and he expressed interest in the thinking of those such as former Director of Central Intelligence James Woolsey and the journalist Thomas Friedman, who argued after the September 11 attacks that, even setting aside the challenge of climate change, America was arming its enemies by failing to wean itself from oil, because oil exporters used their easy cash to challenge American interests. Oil security, it turned out, like other forms of economic security, lay in the eye of the beholder. One of the problems with Feith's arguments about seamless global oil pools forever replenishing themselves was that it required other world powers to act as if they shared his understanding. China, crucially, did not. Its leaders remained steeped in the political science model of oil power. Douglas Feith was a man of exceptional belief in himself, however. He was quite certain that his views of markets, history, and global oil security were correct. Feith's responsibilities included co-chairing ongoing bilateral defense talks with Chinese counterparts. Soon after the invasion of Iraq, he decided to try to talk the Chinese government into changing its understanding of the character of the global oil market to conform to his own. China became a net oil importer in 1993. That followed a much-hyped but failed search, in which Exxon had participated, for massive oil reserves in China's northwest Tarim Basin. It was going to be the new Saudi Arabia and all that kind of thing, an executive involved recalled. What they found, however, were basically dry holes. By 2003, China had grown into the world's second-largest oil consumer, after the United States, and its oil imports were skyrocketing. Around 1999, China's communist leadership coined a go-out policy to encourage state-owned companies and diplomats to prowl the world for oil supplies that China could secure by long-term contract. Go out they did. Trade between China and Africa doubled between 2002 and 2003 to $18.5 billion, most of that described Chinese oil imports. Within a few years, China would invest $44 billion worldwide in oil projects, half in Africa. Its methods struck American intelligence analysts as almost neo-colonial. The Chinese government seemed to place a premium on physically owning oil supplies in the belief that ownership would promote the country's long-term national security. Stephen Hadley asked the Africa Division of the Central Intelligence Agency for an assessment of China's oil deals in Africa. Were they a threat to U.S. national interests? The division's view was that we didn't actually see them as that much of a threat, recalled an official involved in the review, just an economic challenge. The CIA's analysts worried that China could displace U.S.-based oil companies from lucrative production deals in some African countries, but that was about the extent of their concern. David Gordon served as the Bush administration's chief national intelligence officer for economics at the time and participated in White House-led policy reviews. In the summer of 2001, Gordon had spent a month in China, steeping himself in the issues emerging from the country's rapid economic growth. Under the assumption that China was going to be the big economic intelligence story, as he put it, he was struck by China's mercantilist approach to energy. Gordon subscribed essentially to Feit's view that the liquid, integrated nature of the global oil market meant there was no particular advantage for a country to own overseas supplies if it was a net importer. It was more efficient economically to purchase supplies as needed unless a remarkably attractive long-term price contract was on offer. Gordon once gave a talk at a Chinese think tank in which he argued that American and Chinese energy interests basically coincided. The two countries shared an interest in diverse global supplies, political security in the Middle East, and security on the open seas. The Chinese sort of took it all down, but he could see that they did not really think that way.